Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is November 1st, 2018, and I hope you had a good Halloween yesterday. First, I want to talk about a little encounter that I had with an intellectual or somebody who thought that they were an intellectual, what I call textbook geniuses. And I guess my comment is that it's always amazing that these people think that you owe them or that I would owe them some kind of an explanation. So here's the scenario. We're involved in a technical discussion of wind energy. And the person brings up standard fare of the measurements of wind energy and the standard theoretical arguments, and so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that. And basically textbook arguments for what the wind industry is doing today with three-blade wind generators. And the person is approaching me, and then it turns into, well, you have to explain yourself. And then coming to the point of having to refute, or this might have to do with also, I'll talk about this in a minute, a listener, I was communicating, somebody that bought some books, ended up communicating about the order, and then the person asked me, it said that they try to talk to people sometimes about my work in a positive sense, and people go, well, they bring up all of the standard negative stuff. For example, hurricanes. That I, of course, say that hurricanes are not powered by warm water. It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's a textbook argument that people learn and they get it in their head and they somehow think that that's correct when it couldn't possibly be true at all. And so I have actually one of the very first paid casts that I made in my paid cast series was how to deal with people who have learned something from the newspaper, from textbooks, whatever it is, and they go on and they think they're educated and they have facts, and what they really are doing is repeating information which couldn't possibly be true, but they don't even know it. And now you're arguing with somebody who has an emotional stake in this, because they think they're right and they think they're educated. And here's my point, that it somehow comes back to me to not really defend my position, but to spend my time re-educating them, if you understand what I mean. Now, this takes time and effort, and is it my fault that they read something in a textbook, believed it, and then are spewing this, and I'm supposed to take my valuable time, and not only with that, but probably there are 10 related misconceptions that they read in textbooks and believe or heard, or maybe read in popular journals or a lot of the internet journals that are out there that are spewing these totally incorrect ideas. And I'm supposed to take my time, and they get offended because I have a differing opinion. And here it comes down to the basic problem that people do not question. If it's in a textbook, they read it, they write it down on the test, they get an A. Or they read it in a journal, they read it over and over and over again on the trade magazines online, and they are confident in what they're thinking. I never, ever have been like that in my life. And this is not only for the type of things that I'm working on today, whether it's prime numbers. I basically question when I'm looking or reading something. And even when I say I was a freshman doing freshman in college physics, it wasn't that I doubted the book, because basic freshman physics is pretty standard and it's pretty solid and it's pretty well known. And you can do experiments, you know, say the value of gravity at the surface of the Earth, you know, things like that. It's very well known. But I would always put things into perspective. And especially as I got into more advanced studies, especially when you start dealing with outer space or weather or things like that are a little bit more esoteric, they're not as well textbook defined as, say, physics 101 at freshman level or chemistry 101. When you do those chemistry 101 experiments, I mean, they're pretty cut and dry. You know what the result is going to be. Everybody, if you're in Russia or in England or in the United States, you get the same results. And but once you get up into, especially into grad school, things become a little more dicey. That's when you start getting into theories. Let's say plate tectonics. Plate tectonics was a theory that was rooted in what appeared to be good science. But when you really peel back the first two layers of plate tectonics, it doesn't hold water. Yeah, the idea that all of the continents of Earth started in one location and broke apart and moved around the Earth, that's a nice textbook drawing. It makes for a wonderful video with artist conceptions. But in the true scientific sense, there is some secondary and tertiary evidence for things like that. But in the true scientific sense, there's no evidence for that at all, nor for plate tectonics. We see plates moving, but is there another mechanism? Is that what causes mountains to form? I questioned that, and I came to the conclusion that physically, continental plates moving around is a misnomer. That's not like a plate. A plate is an incorrect word because the structure of the Earth is not like a plate. If you picked it up, you imagine going through the food line and somebody's putting food on your plate, and you hold that plate out at the edge, and the plate doesn't fall apart. If you took a big chunk of Earth's crust, 2 miles across even, not 100 miles across, just 2 miles across, if you cut it off with a big chainsaw and tried to lift it all up, it would crumble into little teeny pieces. It is not, I repeat, it is not a plate. And so this is what I'm saying. You get to some of these scientific concepts, and it's really gets very dicey. And people don't question. But back to my original commentary, that when people get hostile, then they because you know they're knowledge based, and of course they think they're smart because they read textbooks and they did a lot of work and they believed everything they read and didn't question it. And that's the whole problem. It comes down to this. People do not question what they're reading. It happens in politics. It happens in everyday life. It happens. That's why a lot of people have trouble just chewing gum and walking down the street at the same time. That's why people have strange misconceptions about life, is because they don't have a handle on reality. They can't take reality and cut it into little pieces and put it back together again and come up with reality. They're living in some kind of strange reality. And, so you get all kinds of strange opinions. But when it comes down to science, and science, let's just put it this way. Let's take plate tectonics, for example, or hurricanes. What powers hurricanes? Or the science of wind energy. If you take any one of those topics, okay, these are fairly esoteric topics. There's opinions. There are long-standing opinions that have been formed about these topics. But when I came along with my questioning attitude, the end result is that I started looking at these and I'm going, wait a minute, these things don't make sense. They don't add up. There's something missing here. There's something awry. And so when I'm in a room or in a contact with somebody who thinks they're educated but never questioned, and then you start interfacing with them, and they start getting hostile because you're offending what they read in a textbook or in a magazine article, and you are basically in a couple, you know, and with, say, wind energy, in a couple of quick statements, I can tell you why the standard beliefs are just hogwash. They don't make sense. They don't add up. They don't apply. But I've talked about this before, and that is the anger that people develop. And it's, anger is not a scientific trait. Anger is a condition that people get when you have crossed their knowledge boundary, so to speak. Anger has no place in science, or emotion. And that's one of the things, you know, that's the Spock image on Star Trek. You know, that he does calculations in his head, he does estimates and does science. He's the science, officer. And he's very unemotional. And in a sense, that's what science should be. But in today's world of science, science is extremely emotional. And when you talk to people, now you're not dealing with a person that is rational. You're not dealing with a person who you can even talk to on a scientific basis. And so when I throw out one or two or three things that are key points to dispelling the myths of, say, plate tectonics or the warm water theory of hurricanes or the standard beliefs about extracting energy from the wind, and the end result is somebody getting extremely angry, that's very difficult to deal with. But the way the modern scientific community also deals with this is ignores it or makes fun of it. And those are the two standard techniques. If you're in the same room with them, they get angry. And when they get angry, then you're supposed to, they're angry. We're supposed to kowtow to that. Well, no, I don't do that at all. But if you're not in the same room, if it's a, say, a journal or a magazine or the people who are in their ivory tower, which is protecting them from any outside intrusion, then they have free rein. They get the money, they get the funding, they get the publications, and it's a little three-ring circus in which they win. And so the reason I'm talking about this is because not only have I encountered this recently, but so have other people. And by the way, if you're out talking about me and my work, I appreciate that. Do me a favor, don't try to interpret what I say to people. And you're going to be doing yourself a favor also. And if you want, listen to my first couple paid casts, which talk about this subject and how to deal with people, and especially if they're family members. This is where it really goes into left field, because now you're dealing with people that there's in most families, there's a certain pecking order of who's smart and who's not, who's capable and who's not. And so it's easy for families and family members to marginalize other family members because of that family pecking order. And so at any rate, if you're dealing especially within families, and especially if some of the people in the families have advanced degrees, masters or doctorates especially, and I always say that the people that are higher up on the education ladder are the most difficult to deal with, because they're set in their belief systems, and you're attacking that if you even question it, and if you bring out any rational explanations or arguments, then you're just asking for trouble, because you know they're going to fall back on years and years of commonality, And that's one of the biggest problems you deal with, is people are not able to question things themselves. They depend on, well, everybody else thinks this, therefore they should also. And so, anyway, I'm not. It's a topic that I just wanted to breach a little bit on this show, in that when you're dealing with people with closed minds, when it comes to science or scientific topics, you're in trouble because they are not scientific, they're not rational. And the original point, I've talked about this whole topic before, but my point here is that then they expect me to spend my time catering to their misinformation and somehow educating them. And all I'm saying is, I don't owe people anything. They owe me an explanation for why they read a textbook, believed it for 10 or 20 years, and never questioned it. That's the true conversation that has to be taken to task. Every week I get emails from people, and here are a couple. One of them has to do with quantum computers, and this was could quantum computers, which of course the idea being that smaller means faster, and if you could get down to the atomic level in scaling digital computing, could you possibly break RSA codes, which are the prime number encryption codes being still used when you go to a website and it says it has SSL, or that's that little lock up in the corner that implies that that site is secure. And what it is using is secure socket layer SSL encryption. And they say usually today's world is 128-bit encryption. And it's really not solid encryption. And the only thing that saves you as a little guy out there using the internet is that there's probably not anybody really interested in you, because you're not a billionaire, you don't have a lot of money, you're not making huge transfers. They're more interested in, say, Target or some corporation that's using SSL encryption to break into their database and get tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of, say, credit cards that they can quick rob, get money, and run. And so the only thing that saves you is that you're not a big fish. And so you can use, you probably could get by without using any encryption. But when you go to a web page and you see that little lock up in the corner, and that implies SSL encryption on that website and that it's secure. And, you know, and it's really a misnomer. It's somebody, it's like a state requiring helmets for motorcycle drivers. You know, it's going to save a few people, but the vast majority of people are going to drive around their whole life without a helmet and not be hurt. And so, but anyway, it's one of those kinds of things. That's kind of an example. So, if you're on the internet, but SSL encryption is a piece of junk. It was broken in 2007 when I published my book Calculate Primes, and anybody and everybody in the industry knew it. It's just that they keep selling this garbage, because if they didn't, they'd have to develop something that actually worked. Okay, so anyway, the article is about quantum computers, and of course the issue with encryption is quickly calculating prime numbers that are factors in the way the public key encryption, or SSL is another term for it, public key encryption. The way it works is you have a big number that has two prime numbers, that is two numbers that have no factors, as factors. And so the ability of someone to find these two factors is very remote. And so anyway, the it's a basis for doing encryption. That's you know, the short-term story. But I have a book out, it's called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, and it shows you literally how to do this. And it's something I made public, because the public should know how easy it is to break these encryption codes. And at any rate, so it's rather, the point of me discussing this is it's rather comical that the industry is still trying to promote the idea that breaking these SSL encryption systems is out in the future because there is no publicly available quantum computer. There are probably some quantum computing experiments in a laboratory, but nothing that would be available on a large scale. And so the idea is that quantum computing in the future might have an effect on the RSA encryption codes or the prime number encryption codes, whatever rosy name you want to apply to them, RSA or SSL or whatever you public key encryption. They're all different names for the same thing, prime number encryption. So anyway, the point of this article is that they're trying to make it sound like out in the future, quantum computing could make some inroads on internet security. So it's all a pile of garbage because in a kind of an effort to educate you, some people may not have have the access to my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, or my Calculate Primes book, which shows you how to calculate primes directly. And it's literally a formula that you calculate prime numbers in groups. And so you start out with zero, literally the number zero. You put it into the formula, you come out with zero and one, and then you put in those two numbers into the formula, you get zero, one, and two. And then you get 0, 1, 2, and 3. Then you get 0, 1, 2, and 3, and 5. Then you get 0, 1, 2, 3, 5, and 7. And it starts generating, in each iteration, it starts generating the prime numbers, but not one at a time, in groups. And as you get out into the larger numbers, the groups get very large. So you're generating prime numbers in groups. And so what this allows you to do is very quickly calculate and generate a table of prime numbers that gets very big very fast. Okay, so now, just to give you an idea, when you're using standard computational brute force methods to break RSA codes or public key encryption or SSL or whatever you want to call it, you take the public key, which is one of the prime numbers, and or the large number, which is the key, and then you try and find the two factors. And so with the turns out that they're usually about the same size, the same number of digits, or in binary, the same number of bits. And there's a reason for that, because if they made one smaller, it would be easier to find that number using the brute force method. So because of that, they tend to try to locate numbers that are about the same size. So it's equally difficult to locate either one of them, because what you're doing is, by brute force, you're dividing this big number by 2, then by 3, then by 5, then by 7, then by 11, all the prime numbers up to the square root of that big number. And so then you have to basically... it's a long, long process. And if you just use standard computing processes, it takes a very long time. The average person's computer doesn't have that much computing power. So breaking RSA codes fundamentally should be statistically impossible unless you were very lucky at guessing. Okay, so, but what I do is take a totally different tact. That is, if you can start with a very large number of prime numbers in a table, now your test to find factors is very easy, because all you got to do is check the lower couple digits and the higher couple digits to see if it matches, and then do a size test to see if the product of your two numbers from your table match the size of the big number. And so very quickly you can identify from your existing table of prime numbers, and that's the difference, is because you're beginning with a big table of numbers, which are prime numbers. And this you were able to get with any average computer could do it. And you have that table existing, and all of these prime numbers, up to very large prime numbers. And so breaking the RSA codes is very easy to do. Like I say, the only thing that allows you to be safe is that you're just a small fry out on the internet, and there's probably nobody that's sitting at your doorstep with some kind of monitor looking for your credit card information, because you're not a big fish. You're not worth enough money for them to spend their time doing that. So you could get by pretty much the same without any encryption at all. And somebody's getting to sell a product, this SSL product or whatever, which doesn't work technically, but it gives people the false sense of security. It's kind of like hitting a brick wall with your seatbelt on at 100 miles an hour. If you miss the wall, 99% of the people simply don't get hurt because they miss the wall. It's the one person that hits the wall that has the problem. And so it gives you the illusion of safety, because the vast majority of people don't hit the wall. And it's just like the motorcyclist not wearing a helmet is a similar example. Statistically, you're probably okay if you don't wear a helmet. But if you happen to be in an accident, then it's not okay, because you're probably going to get hurt pretty bad and by not wearing a helmet. But it's the same way as going on the internet. If you had no security of any kind at all, most of the time, 99.999999% of the time, you would be safe. And so this SSL deal gives you a false sense of security. Plus, now they've got it set up so that if you don't have it on your web page, nobody will access your web page. A little message comes up saying, "He does not have secured socket layer. Don't go there. Could be viruses." And that's a complete bunch of baloney, because you can have viruses and cookies and all kinds of things that will load into your computer and have SSL. They don't go out and test your website to see if it has Trojans or invasive software at a website. That is complete bunk. So your website security is not related to what they are doing or selling. Anyway, it's like lots of things. Okay, so on to the next topic. And this one is very interesting, because I saw a special some time ago. So this email from a listener caught my attention. I saw a special, and it was talking about the city of Venice. And of course, we have all heard the dire predictions of coastal invasion of the oceans because of global climate change and the melting of the ice caps. Okay, so a good example, there are places, there's probably a dozen places around the world which are old cities that have been there for a long time, that they're worried about the ocean level rising. But this is an interesting story, because for the first time ever, there is a satellite that has the ability to measure within a millimeter, which is a pretty small measurement, within a millimeter of the altitude of a certain given location on Earth. So what they've been doing is mapping the city of Venice. And it's been sinking into the ground, because it's basically built on very soggy ground, and these buildings are big, and they're massive stone buildings, solid stone buildings. And so they're sinking. Now, the ocean level rise prediction of global warming people is a certain number of millimeters per century. So far, the inundation of water, ocean waters in Venice, and this is due to sea rise and tides and other effects, but the effect due to global warming, actual rise in sea level, has yet to be detected. And so Venice is building a series of break walls. They're like gates. They're like big cement gates that can come up and lock and keep the oceans out during these periods of elevated ocean levels because of tidal, because of tides. And these happen occasionally, and they're predictable. But the bottom line is that the so-called measurements, or the point is, they finally have made exact measurements down to the millimeter, showing that there is no effect on Venice due to rising ocean levels. The special feature documentary that I saw a couple months ago, however, only talked about Venice putting up these gates. It had animations showing how they're building these. It talked to the, I think it was a woman, who was in charge of this gate system to prevent the tidal surges from coming into Venice. And so that was all very good, but they only talked about the tidal, or they only talked about the sea level rise due to global warming. And so this measurement by a satellite proved that, number one, there has never been an increase in the sea level due to global warming. But now they have a standard and they can measure it, but they've also mapped the city of Venice sinking and the rate at which it's sinking. And so this is the problem with Venice. It's not ocean levels rising. It is the fact that the city is sinking. And that's the issue. There's a movie, I think it's a James Bond movie, where they go under some of these buildings in Venice which have big flotation diaphragms, big balloons, and they're underneath the building to hold it up to keep it from sinking. These are massive buildings in Venice. So anyway, that's very interesting. And I also noted just the other day that they're talking about Mexico City, a place where I lived for a while when I was young. And the Teotihuacan was the old Aztec city that was basically a lake. It was a lake bed. And if you've ever been in Mexico City, beautiful, beautiful city, it's a bowl. It's basically the caldera of an ancient volcano. So when the Aztecs were there, there was a lake, a shallow lake, and they built their temples out in the lake, and they had causeways. And that's what made it a little difficult for the Spanish when they were actually doing some of their attacks, is that the Aztecs had their defenses set up based on the causeways, which you had to cross. And if, from a military point of view, if you can't make a broad-scale attack, if you have to come out these little narrow causeways, it makes it very much more difficult for the attacking armies. And so, but anyway, the point is that it was a lake, and then Mexico City was built on the top of it. But some of these neighborhoods, now they have been pumping water out of the aquifer that sits under the city, and some of those aquifers are drying up, and the city of Mexico is sinking by inches a year. Some of these regions within Mexico City. Now we're going to go down to Tampa, Florida, and the sinkholes that are north of Tampa, Florida. There's been an issue in recent years with sinkholes where they literally, the houses, you probably have read about some where a guy was sleeping in bed and his whole house was sucked down into the earth by a sinkhole. And I spent some time down in Tampa before the hurricane. What was it, Irma? I forget the name of the hurricane. Chased me out of there. That was in August of 2017. And you may have heard my radio show where I was actually driving through Atlanta, Georgia, when I called in live to do my radio show. while I was on the highway being chased north by that hurricane. Anyway, so I had spent some time down in the Tampa, Florida region. almost settled there, and then I decided, some issues there. But the sinking property is one of them. You could buy a house, and all of a sudden next week it would be declared unlivable because of sinkholes. And a sinkhole is simply caused by the fact that a limestone deposit deep in the ground is eroding away continually because of water erosion, and then the dry sand above it. Now, here's the issue. Tampa is water hungry, just like Mexico City. Tampa, Florida, is very water hungry city, and this is happening in a lot of places too. And so what they're doing is they're pumping water out of the aquifer that is north of Tampa, going up to 100 miles north of Tampa. And that's sand. Now, if you've ever been to the beach and you go down right next to where the water's washing up and the sand is compacted and it's very hard. You can walk on it. It's almost like concrete. It's so hard. Your foot doesn't sink down in it. But as soon as you go up above that water line, now you're in the loose, dry sand. Dry sand does not have any structure. It doesn't have any strength. It doesn't have any ability to hold up structures. And so if you pump the water out from underground, you're vacating the sand that's underneath that region north of Tampa. And this is the cause of sinkholes, or the increased cause. There always were sinkholes in that region, but now it's becoming more and more common. Okay, so the point is that going back to Venice, the point is that now we have a reference frame from which to actually make measurements. There's a satellite that is able to measure within a millimeter the altitude of a given location down to the, you know, very small area. So we're able to actually detect in Venice or Mexico City or other places the actual sinking of the land. And this is where the actual science comes in. This is what science is all about. It's about measurements. And let's go back to those three areas that I talked about before. I talked about hurricane development, I talked about plate tectonics, and I talked about wind energy. And even though a lot of measurements have been made over wind energy, the idea that, let's say hurricanes, where the standard idea is that it's formed from heat of water, which is, you know, couldn't possibly be true. There's simply not enough energy there. But if you make actual measurements and calculations, which I've done, and you calculate the heat loss as a hurricane passes over an area, then there's not enough energy there to create this storm. If you calculate the momentum in the storm and the energy, the velocity, the mass of the water in the air, etc., there's a zillion times more energy in that hurricane than comes from evaporated water. A very simple calculation to make, but people don't do it. People will refuse to spend their time doing these very, very simple calculations, or in the case of plate tectonics, there's simply not good measurements available to show that plate boundaries that are out in the middle of the ocean can somehow push hard enough to create mountains in the center of continents. Because the ultimate reason is that the plates, there really is no such thing as a plate in the earth. As I said before, a plate is a misnomer. A plate implies something solid, that if you push on one side, the other side moves over, that it's a solid entity, integrally connected, all sides of it. And that's not the case with earthbound plates. So if you take even if you could identify, which they have never done, they've never identified the horizontal force agents that move entire continents around the place, but even if you created one, say you took a big set of hydraulic rams and big steel plates, and you started to, with the hydraulics, move these plates apart, and push on the continental plates in two directions, it would all deform right there. It would not create a mountain in the middle of the continent 3,000 miles away. So the idea of a plate tectonic somehow creating mountains looks nice in a textbook. The idea of plates subducting one under the other looks nice in a textbook. But the reality is there's no science behind it. It's some guy drawing a picture in a textbook, getting a paycheck, everybody believing him, and therefore everybody will repeat that plate tectonics is somehow a proven scientific fact when it is not at all. It's absolutely not at all. So at any rate, okay, so I'm going to move on from that. But yeah, from the latest measurements, the ocean levels are not rising, causing Venice to become inundated. The fact is that Venice is sinking, and that's what's causing the problems there. So anyway, but it puts it more on a scientific basis, which finally is good. We can stop this back and forth. He said, she said, the global climate people say this, and they're all in the same camp, therefore it must be true. Now we finally have some real measurements which are showing that it is not ocean levels rising, even though, yes, if you took the Greenland ice cap and the Antarctic ice caps, the two big ones, and they melted into the ocean, then you would have sea level rising, correct. But the other thing is now they're starting to measure the thickness of the Antarctic ice plate. And so even though some of the edges, they talk about icebergs breaking off and floating away, it's actually getting thicker. So you cannot take a vertical picture, a top-down picture of Antarctica, and try and measure its area, the surface area, because that's two dimensions. It's growing in the third dimension, in the vertical dimension. And by the way, they only concentrate on certain areas that are diminishing. The overall Antarctic ice pack area, that is, if you look from a vertical perspective, has actually been increasing. And so, at any rate, it's a way to basically try and support an unsupportable dialogue with data and not looking at the entire data set. But as I said, Antarctica is growing. The actual ice pack down there is growing. But then again, people don't count the fact that the Earth has an influx of water on a daily basis. So the equations that are being used, the water, the water in the Earth, both the liquid water and the vapor water, the water vapor on Earth, the two very big factors are not included. One is the hydrological cycle, which brings the water to the north and the south pole, where it freezes and it does not leave again. And the fact that there's an influx of water on a daily basis. So there's other factors involved here. And another little issue is that the Earth is self-monitoring. If it becomes warmer, then you get more evaporation off the waterbeds, and it forms clouds and blocks the sun, because that white clouds reflect the sunlight. So if the Earth gets cooler, then not as much evaporation occurs, there's not as many clouds, and it tends to heat up. So the Earth has a self-regulating climate system that keeps us in this zone, kind of like the zone that we're living in now, where if it gets too hot, then the clouds will cause it to cool down. And I am still trying to find a climatologist who will tell me that when it's cloudy, it's getting warmer. It's somehow allowing more energy into Earth. That I have yet to find one, and if they did, I'd have to think twice about the validity of their degree. But the Earth has a self-regulating energy system in the clouds that works very well. It's worked all along, and it keeps us regulated. It's kind of our thermostat. And, of course, people don't talk about that. Of course, there's an election coming up here soon. I have kept away from this topic completely. I'm sorry I missed John Moore's show this week. I was out of radio range. But the week before on John Moore, he opened up by talking about the caravan coming up from Central America, the caravan of people. And right now, I think probably one of the biggest issues in the United States is immigration. And very interesting, I was talking to somebody that just visited Iceland. And it turns out that Iceland has an immigration policy in which they allow 100 people per year into their country to become, to start the citizen naturalization process. And it turns out that that's the most that they will accept in 1 year, and they're highly vetted. In other words, they have to meet the standards of the country. There's only a bit over 300,000 people in Iceland. And so it's a very small, well-knit community of people, and relatively poor. They're what all reports, they're very happy people. But in terms of immigration, the issue is that the issue is coming down to one of immigration. And so I think that this will be where the elections will be won and lost in this upcoming election. I'm not telling people how to vote, etc. I have my own personal opinions. But the basically it comes down to, do you want immigration policies or not? One side has tightening immigration policies. The other side has basically open borders. Just let anybody in that wants to come in, and don't even talk to them. Just let them in, and that's the two options you have. So immigration is a big issue, and I'm not going to go into this myself, but it appears that for most people that I talk to, that's one of the very first things on their mind is the issue of immigration, and whether do you want to open up the border and just let everybody in, or do you want to close the border and let selective people in? That seems to be one of the major issues. So without becoming politically ingrained in one side or the other, like I say, I have my own opinions based on my life experiences. And quite frankly, if you've never, let me just put it this way. If you've never lived in a third world country, then you can't imagine it. You can't imagine what the cultures are like. And the assumption that all people are equally good is simply not true. The problems in third world countries are horrendous. The economic problems, but the social problems are horrendous also. And so it's just very, very difficult to open up the borders completely and without any vetting of any kind at all. And also, if you've gone to Cancun, for example, that's not Mexico. If you've gone to a five-star resort on the coast of Costa Rica, that is not Costa Rica. And so, you would not understand the cultures, which are very different. Their norms are very different. Their ethics are very different. Their way of seeing things are very different. Their ways of communicating, their ways of acting, their ways of getting what they want are very different. And so unless you've been in a third world country, which I have, I've spent a good deal of time in third world countries, with the rich and with the poor. So I understand both sides of that equation. But it's unfortunate. I've always said that Americans, students who get out of high school, instead of going right to college, which in most cases I call advanced babysitting, they should go to a third world country with a one-way ticket and have to work their way back. In other words, work amongst the people, the poor people, to earn enough money to buy their plane ticket to come back, and or boat trip or whatever it is. But one-way ticket to a third world country where you have to become immersed in the poor population of that country. And believe me, the United States would be a very, very different place. Absolutely different. Okay, so anyway, the election coming up, I would encourage everybody to get out and vote. And I will end by saying this, that in the November election 2016, the presidential election, I went through a whole analysis of cheating. The level of cheating in the 2018 November election will dwarf the cheating that went on in the 2017 presidential election. And so if you want to look back at my lectures on that around the 2016 October, November, December, January time frame, and basically it's a liberal phenomenon. What we found out was the biggest level of cheating, which was to my surprise, after actually doing the study prior to the election and then seeing the results after the election, was that the majority of cheating was in the local precincts, where the local precinct people actually changed the votes and increased the votes and diminished the votes. And this was primarily for Democrats increasing votes and decreasing the votes of Republicans. And those are just facts. Those are factual statements that has nothing to do with political bias. But if you're voting on the Republican side, just simply understand that for every vote cast, there's probably an equal and opposite illegal vote or cheating vote on the other side. So it's going to take great numbers of red votes, for example, to offset illegal blue votes. And those are just, it's not politically motivated. It's simply the scientific result that I was able to observe. And I have a white paper on this. So at any rate, that's something this next coming Tuesday, get out and vote. And if you want to take part in something, here's what I would suggest, that you check out the exit polls. Exit polls are the best way to see if there is a level of cheating. And also, there were certain cheating centers, especially big cities in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, the Los Angeles area, San Francisco, the Portland, Seattle areas in the upper northwest, Florida, down in Dade County, big, big cheating center. And then some other ones. Chicago was one of the biggest cheating centers. So anyway, those are some of the bigger ones. New York City also, where the ballot box was stuffed. So if you go out and vote, understand that it's going to take an awful lot of red votes to overcome the blue cheating votes. And those are just statistical numbers. Those are verifiable statements, general statements. Okay, so enough of that. I just want to remind you that my water filter products are still on sale. I encourage people to take a look at the whole house filters. And when you purchase the whole house filters, the replacement filter sets are very inexpensive. Let's just put it that way. So when people buy a whole house filter, and the MR5, the smaller of the two, is very much capable of handling literally any house, any household in the United States. If you start getting up to uses like watering gardens and other water usages, then you would probably look for the MR9. But you can also check this out in total gallons per minute. The smaller the MR5 will run up to 7 gallons a minute, and the larger the MR9 will run up to 12 gallons per minute. That's a lot of water. And that's with the washing machine running, the two showers going, the kitchen water going, somebody in the second bathroom taking a shower. You know, the MR9 would be enough for a really big house or a small hotel complex, for example. So anyway, those are on the webpage. Sale prices are still up there. JMCCSCI.com. Also my books, my paid cast, and also just a note to my paid cast listeners, as the final weeks of the XPRIZE wound down and ended, and then a bunch of activity, etc., related to that and other business ventures, I've been just absolutely swamped. So I'm getting back to filling in those blank weeks on the paid cast. So if you're missing paid casts, just be assured that I'll be making those up very soon, because that's a very important part of my basically my information, moving it out to the my listener base. Because right now I'm dealing with discussions, dealing with my books. And so we're still right now in the middle of the weather book, and then moving on to the other books in the future. So very important to have these for posterity, where I make additional comments on the contents of my books and my theoretical structure, which is actually very extensive. And also on the webpage. So also the water tanks, a lot of people should look into investing in a water tank. And those are available also for the 48 states. The water tanks are available. And also, if anybody is interested, I also have my product line of the water machines, the atmospheric water generators, which I used in the XPRIZE. And just a quick summary on the XPRIZE, I was awarded the XPRIZE, the Technology Innovation Achievement Award. That's an annual award from the XPRIZE, and I captured that and won that. So that's a big plus. And so culminating a year and a half of work and a lot of other things going on there. Out of 100 companies, I came in second. And primarily that was because I had a technical difficulty with basically a PC board on one of my electronic pieces of equipment. So otherwise I would have won that, the XPRIZE Water Abundance XPRIZE. At any rate, all is good. All is moving forward. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.